would entertain a motion for the approval of the agenda. Motion made and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Approval of the minutes. Going once.
Oh.
Motion made and seconded for the approval of the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Aye.
It's right. It's right.
We can't vote.
First item up, station naming policy. Here we go.
Here we go. I'm back again.
I would say that after the staff presentation and before board debate, there will be time for input or participation in this in our regular 2-minute window. So,
okay. Barbara Richardson, Chief of Staff, and I'm here to discuss station naming policy. To begin with, I wanted to just touch base on some of the actions we've taken and that the board has taken over the last year when we've been discussing this topic. First of all, you had approved updates to the policy. We had a lot of discussion and in response to customer research that we did, you adopted a primary and secondary approach to address the long station names that were in the system. You confirmed support around a 19-character limit and a 13-character limit for transfer stations. And we clarified that to 19 and 13 characters for both primary and secondary, so total character count. Also, that landmark in the station names, again, this was from information we received from customers who said that any landmark in a station name ought to be right near where the station is, so we have now a limit of a half a mile or 1 walking distance. You reaffirmed the importance of the community involvement piece in the policy, and we also, for the time, added a customer research provision. Also, since over the last year, and actually in April, we finalized the Silver Line names in time to meet the deadline that we had with the project team to begin station for the Silver Line to begin the station signage work. And I would just like to say that the process that evolved with Fairfax County and with WMATA staff was really very collaborative. And I thought that it provided an example for how we could proceed further with names, sort of marrying the community outreach with the customer research piece. So I thought it was a really great process, I would say. And of course, on June 18th, we put the new Rush Plus map out into the system, and some of the highlights there are we had put National Mall is now labeled on the map in 2 locations to help signify that we have multiple stations by which that you can access the mall. We also did the National Malls to make it more visible, and I think this was a suggestion of past board member, Jeff McKay, who said that. We've also added the international symbol of H for hospitals on the map, so we have 3 of those that are on in the maps. And, of course, the most important reason for the map change was to reflect our new service pattern and the Rush Plus service pattern. Next page, please. So back in the fall, you asked that we take another look at the policy itself, and to look at the practical operational policy aspects of a couple of the different types of names, higher education or the colleges and universities that are on there, hospitals and institutions, and also to review again the commercial naming rights issue a little bit in context with the practical and operational aspects, and to review ways or tools that we have now that help people find their way through the system. Next slide. So I'd like to first start with this practical aspect of it for on the operation side as well as the customer. The important piece of this is that A station name change has implications through just about everything that we do, and it's not just about the map or signs. It carries through how we make announcements and how customers hear announcements. And through this whole process, we continue to come back to the fact that the shorter and more concise a name, the better for customers, because of repetition and the hearing it and knowing where they're going, and also the visual, the quick visual read of signage so they understand what directions they're going. But it also, in this 14-character Twitter world also that we live in, the shorter the better, too. We have passenger information display signs that are 8 characters. Our bus signs on the outside for the destinations are 9 to 16 characters. In the inside of our rail cars, there are 13 character limits. And as we're working on together on the new 7K series cars, we have 14 car limits there, although we have lots of opportunity to provide promotion and to provide information about destinations, because we will have video screen signs, as we've shown before, in the new rail cars. But we also have ADA considerations that we need to take into account, because all of these names then do need to be converted to Braille, and we need to match the signs and have the Braille on the signs. And when you have really, really, really long names, it becomes a problem for that community to get the right Braille signage on there. Next slide. Another aspect that we had not previously talked much about in the last couple of times that I was, what I've been before you, is the future map. So I just offer this up as a quick look at what happens when we now have 3 rail lines going through the core of the system. And even this is just a quick look at one of the drafts that Lance Wyman did. And even with thinning down the colors, a little bit without changing the character of the design, it becomes very tight. And what says is, I think that we just need to be continue to be vigilant and mindful of what we're putting on there, and less is more in this instance, so that people and travelers can quickly see where they're going. Next slide. So on this last round, which we did quite a bit of work on, we reached out to Chip Properties. We, with the help of the board secretary's office, sent out a survey on all the different types of institutions, and also we asked about commercial naming rights. We touched base with the outdoor advertising agencies to ask them a couple questions about commercial naming rights. We took into account the extensive community input that we had in the last round. Many, many, many people voiced their opinion over the last year on names. In addition to the 6 previous focus groups, we conducted 4 more focus groups on some options. And we did all the tools that we had out there to help people find where they're going. So that's where I'd like to start. What actually, besides a station name, what other tools do we have in Metro to help people find their way around the region and the system? And one of the big helpers that we have is the neighborhood maps are in each of the stations, and here's an example. And they include places of interest, government buildings, connecting transportation services. And in the process of doing research, I'll tell you that we found that a lot of people do rely on them, that they will go look at them for a sense of place and direction as to where to go. In addition, we have extra tools on the website. The Trip Planner has a feature on it where you find a station near a location. It will help you find where you're going. If you put in, for instance, the National Building Museum, it'll show you how to get there in the system. We have the interactive map, which I mentioned before in a Rush Plus presentation, where if you scroll over, and thanks to Google, you scroll over a station and you enter in what it is that you're looking for, a restaurant, if you put restaurants, for instance, and then several restaurants will pop up on the screen, and then you can scroll over and you can find out which one is where. In addition to that, as I mentioned, we're working, the 7K trains are continuing in design and production, or design stage, and we will have video displays which will allow us further to put destinations on those screens
for each of the station stops. So what is at that particular stop? We'll be able to put parking, we'll be able to indicate what museums are there, what landmarks are there. Mobile apps, we were very aggressive, Metro has been aggressive in having our information available to private developers, and many mobile apps that many in the region really depend heavily on. And in addition to that, I will just add that as we're working further on the neutral host, connecting the whole system up, there is even greater connectivity to the web apps than have been ever before. We have 20 stations on, and we're continuing to build the connections in between. But those are the things that we do, but others are also doing help, are also providing help. There are joint promotions that we do with a lot of the culture institutions, a lot of the landmarks. In fact, Destination DC, we have done a summer promotion with them, Metro, and they have interactive maps. So if you want to go somewhere in the region, and we will automatically come up as how you get there. They'll do that for us too. So they're promoting us. And also, other places have their own maps that they, you know, similarly. So some of the museums have and also promote how to get to the particular museum. The Metro. So what do the other transit agencies do? Similar to us, they have an interactive map. They also have mobile apps. And some have destination guides, though. They do guides online of institutions or schools that are in a particular area of a station. So those are some of the things that others do. The customer feedback that we, because we asked them about how do you learn where you're going and what's the best way to do that, and there was continued emphasis on not adding what we have to try to keep the map as it is and not, they're very sensitive to the clutter that could exist. They encouraged us to continue to develop and to work with developers on apps. And also just sort of online digital tools, because more and more people are plugged in, more and more people are using those tools actively. And that's where also we learned about that they really rely a lot on the state maps, so we should probably take a look at those. And third-party sites, what some of the comments that came back were, if I am going to a particular location, I'm more likely to go to that institution's website to find out how to get there than I am to look for it through the Metro website. So that was helpful to know. From our side, what we're recommending on this in this particular area to be more helpful to customers is to take a look at our station signage that we have today. And a lot of our signs also have and will point people to the landmarks that are in that area too, I should say that. But once we get through the second phase of the signage changeover related to Rush Plus is to sort of step back and say, over time we have lots of different kinds of signs. What is most helpful and what should be the standard for the signs in the stations? The second piece that we want to do is look at how to more actively or prominently promote finding particular spots, landmarks, institutions on our own website. So it could be that maybe we need a spot that says, how do I get to a pull-down bar or something like that, so that we could be more helpful people. And then promotion of the mobile apps themselves. I think it was a conversation that we're thinking maybe we should ask our riders, what's your favorite mobile app? And then share it with other riders rather than having Metro choose it. We should ask our customers what they think their favorites are. So those are some of the things I think that, you know, that we do today, but also steps that we could take to even be more helpful, I think, to customers find places when they're on the system. And questions or comment at this point? Yes.
I'm very glad that you're doing more with interactive online ways of getting information, but there are some riders on the system who are not connected to the internet, and we need to continue to come up with ways to inform them about how to get around. I don't have a good idea, but no, we're going more and more to interactive. We got to remember that that's not going to do it for some people.
Yes. Okay. On to the next area. So, search. So, what were other agencies doing? And I can talk about a few examples, but I will tell you that it is mixed. Some agencies allow just about everything. In Boston, you see academic institutions, you have specific names of landmarks in the names. Right now, there's an RFP out that they have to start doing cultural naming rights for 11 of their most historic stations. They've indicated that they will be adding the names that change the historic station names. As we've talked before, in Denver, they've sold the rights. There's the Sports Authority Field at Mile High is one. And, of course, SEPTA has AT&T station. They don't have hospitals or schools. They're not on the map. Chicago has released a very aggressive RFP policy. A whole range of sponsorship opportunities are being presented there. And then there are those that don't allow specific institutions or even commercial naming rights as well. New York has one that we're aware of, and mostly they hold tight to the historic names. The one that we're aware of is the Barclay Center in Brooklyn that I believe was for a capital investment for commercial purposes. But okay. All right. Oh, sorry. Two. All right. Is it Barclays? Oh, okay. Yeah. That's not me. Okay. So in the higher education area, so if we could take each of these as maybe just one at a time, our practice has been that we've permitted it. It has come through the jurisdictional requests. But it is very inconsistent with how the schools are treated, meaning some are abbreviated, some are partial abbreviations, some are simple letters. On the transit agency side, others, some allow it and some don't, as I mentioned before. What we heard from the riders in this next round of focus group work was that we should stay with what we have, but if it's, you know, they think that it, if it's related to college or university, it ought to be the main campus, and that it should be within a half a mile. So that fits what we heard previously, I will say, because previously we also heard that, you know, no shuttle bus, the shuttle bus thing, it needs to be within walking distance. So it's somewhat consistent with the kinds of themes that we've heard before. So our options are to retain our current practice, which is a little bit flexible, to grandfather all that we have. Another proposal that we've heard previously was to move all the higher education institutes to a secondary name category. I think given what we heard previously, there would be a lot of community comment on that and disagreement with that approach. I would anticipate that. We heard quite a bit from Gallaudet, for instance, when we looked at that. Or in the future, we could limit to main campus with a half a mile. The little marks with the four squares are what I would put forth as a recommendation, that we grandfather what we have on the existing map, but make a change in policy that says going forward, if we have a college or university or school, that it should be the main campus and should be within a half a mile. So just stop there for comments on that.
Question. Defining main campus, Mike, I'm just wondering how that's going to be, because a lot of new schools that are popping up And unless you kind of limit it, in other words, a significant university presence or something like that, I'm just curious.
We could probably put an enrollment, or we could probably come up with some way to define that.
Yeah, all these new schools popping up all over the place. You could have somebody come in and say, okay, I've got, you know, 50 students. This is my main campus. I'm going to name one of the stations. So just think about it.
Yeah, how to define it further. Sure. Yeah.
Ms. Porter.
I would agree with that comment, but I also think that it is important to continue to keep the university identifications in the name that we've got, mm-hmm. at least. I would agree with the grandfathering and also allow some opportunity for additional universities to be named under the process that we've currently got now. It may be that the majority of riders don't care about where the university is, but you've got a very significant set of riders. For example, people who are looking for, you know, classes, taking occasional classes at the university, or students being new to the area, for whom these kinds of identifications could be very important. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with your recommendation, but I did want to emphasize that I think keeping university names as identifiers would be an important thing. Okay.
Jan Cole.
Yeah, I would agree with Ms. Porter. Not only universities for potential students, but also they have many events at these universities, cultural events and such that are advertised as such, and that certainly would aid in getting people to the right place.
I have one other question. I'm trying to recall, I think when I was in Paris last, at their stations, they have sort of like a board at the station and a list of things that are in there. It's not on the station name, but it's just a list mm-hmm. of things with arrows pointing, that sort of, just to kind of give you a general direction. And I'm wondering if there's some potential for something like, I mean, that's probably going beyond the neighborhood map, but also, quite honestly, and this is my economic development hat on, is to the extent that you basically could charge people if they want to have their name put up there. And turn into a revenue-producing operation. In other words, it wouldn't be named the station name. Sort of a map that lists some of the entities or institutions that are in that area and pointing in a direction. And if they want to put some money up to have that name there, then you know, we might as well explore. It's just a thought. I mean, maybe it's crazy you didn't want to do it, but for some reason, I have a recollection that that's what they did in Europe at some of the stations.
Yeah, it sounds like an expanded version of maybe some of the signage that we do where we point.
Yeah, I interrupted. That's exactly what I was going to suggest. There are existing signs that show street maps and such, and major, let's say, items like a library or a school sometimes in a lot of the maps. Mm-hmm. Now, they do exist on the platforms in many places, but maybe double-checking to make sure they're not just on the platforms but actually on the entrances outside the fair gates. That would be helpful to folks as well. And if they do exist, it's just a matter of taking a look at it and adjusting it.
I think everybody knows I'm objective on this topic. So I appreciate my colleague saying everything I need to have to say. But I did also want to make a point as an investigation. I mean, you could always define it as iconic institutions that would take care of mine. But on a serious note, just in terms of economic development, thank you, one of our products. I think sometimes we forget, and certainly the Board of Trade and the D.C. Chamber has tried to raise this issue in terms of the presence and impact of higher education in terms of economic, the economics in the Washington community. And when you look at non-government employers, the top five is university. So it's not just about getting students there, it's also employees and how we also drive economic development in the city.
Jamie, you could help me define the main kids. How I could work with you on how you do.
Well, I think Jim makes a great point because, you know, the market of higher education is changing. I mean, you know, you and I can decide we're going to start school tomorrow and name it the Artist Barber at 5th and G. It would be our main campus. So I think it is. So I think we need to add other kinds of criteria having to do with more in terms of how old the institution is, what's actually offered, the number of students. I mean, that would be a way, I think, to better get at how we limit what it means by main campus. Mm-hmm. I think there are other criteria we add to that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mr. Bolger.
I'm not on this committee, but just having gone through this commercial station naming most recently and kind of got involved in it pretty heavily with the first place baseball team, the Nationals. Yeah. And I just got to tell you, I'm opposed at this point of, you know, going down that road. There was just too many unknowns to deal with: commercial naming rights, trademark issues, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not the least of which, when I told the Nationals that they had signed an agreement that they wouldn't move the team, they blew their mind. I said, well, they've moved the team twice. You know, we've lost two baseball teams. This is the third one we've had. It's just so much of a big can of worms on the commercial naming rights side. So, Barbara, I don't think we should even go there.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that topic.
Oh, good.
Okay. Landmarks. So today they are permitted, and you did change the policy to say going forward within a half a mile walking distance is important with landmarks. On the research side, again, some of the agencies have some don't. Most are like us in that in our policy it makes reference to that they are should be historical or geographically significant, which I recognize you could differently, but how I take it is you get up out of the station and you say, whoa, there is this, right? So, I mean, it's significant enough where it's very striking to you that is the place. It's a place finder. Customer said it should be in the name only if the institution is really, the big reason. I guess it's the woe factor, the big reason why people use that station. They say keep the ones that are there today, leave them alone, which kind of seems to be a continuing theme, just leave it alone. And but going forward, that if you add them, it needs to be something very major. Disagree about minor, adding minor institutions, although, you know, when you start to describe that much more specifically. So the options really are to maintain what we have, to grandfather the existing institutions, and which I would recommend both of these, that we sort of stay where we are. It does allow flexibility for us. But to the extent that we can develop these tools that I was mentioning, that we try to encourage other institutions that would add to names and continue to expand them to become a part of this other kind of wayfinding community that we would truly, really try to work on. So that's my recommendation.
Can I ask a quick question?
I'm sorry. And then.
Yeah, I wanted to bring, and I assume this is the appropriate time to bring it up. The chair of the board did get two letters this week, one from the National Park Service, Department of Interior, the National Mall and Memorial Parks section, and the other one from the Trust for the National Mall, promoting and recommending the name at Smithsonian be adjusted to include National Mall. And be honest, they make pretty strong arguments that it is meeting the criterion, even though we may have a little issue with the number of letters. And I think to some degree, their preference, obviously, based on the organizations that submitted the request, would prefer to see National Mall with Smithsonian being the smaller letters or the secondary letter, although certainly in the case of the Department of Interior, they've indicated that they would be happy with Smithsonian with the National Mall as the secondary lettering. So I wanted to put that on the record, and I don't know whether we're going to vote on anything like this today.
Could I say that both organizations have signed up to speak to the committee today.
Oh, okay, all right.
And both are here to speak.
Okay, well, she was asking for a comment, and I wanted to make sure that's
in the record. I just wanted to make sure you knew.
Yes,
that they,
I wasn't aware they were here, but.
After we get through this presentation.
Excellent.
They're going to on that exact issue, and then I think it would be
all right.
Appropriate time for the board.
Thank you. And I'm kind of representing Marcel on the committee today because he had to go to a meeting, so I do have a vote, I think.
Oh, yes, sir.
Are landmarks generally included on the neighborhood maps located in the station, even if they're not in the station names, meaning, you know, any national, federal, museum, whatever type thing, they're all on the map?
The places of interest are included.
I think, Mr. Downey.
In addition to the neighborhood maps, I think a number of them would be better served as well if we had good wayfinding inside the station. Sometimes we have that, a good way of an excursion for the White House. Other times, you sort of say, I know it's here somewhere. But the best system I ever seen was
in Beijing, where they literally had everything identified to exactly which stairway you should climb if you wanted to see Mao's tomb, the Army Navy Museum.
Might be good if you send me to go look at that.
Yeah. Any other comments? Keep going.
With hospitals, so recognizing we have a public service that we could provide, came up with the international symbol for the H, which we put on the latest version of the map. The transit agencies, again, some allow them, but some don't also, and that the customer feedback, they were supportive of the international symbol. They knew what it was. They recognized it. They did mention, though, that they use a variety of means to figure out how to get to specific hospitals. So some said that if, you know, I was going there, I wouldn't necessarily use the metro. On the, you know, but there are various reasons why people go. It's not that you're just going for treatment. There are, you know, there are lots of reasons why you would go to a major hospital. So the options are to retain the current practice, which signifies the hospitals with an H, what we really have adopted as a new practice, or to remove it. And I would recommend that we retain it. I think that it provides a nice service, and that we stay with it as the icon to help as a service for our customers.
Are all the hospitals identified by name on the neighborhood maps in the station?
You know, I will go and verify that for you. I'm not certain, but if they're not, we certainly could make that change.
Some of the people come to hospitals may not be connected to the internet and may be relying on information that they can get without being online. And so I think it would be very useful for the hospital symbol gets you part of the way, but then you want to know what hospital and exactly how you get to it from the station. So I would like to suggest that we make sure. I mean, it's not that there's that many hospitals that are close to metro stations. Nobody's going to be walking 3 miles to the hospital, but the ones that are within our, okay, to make sure that they are all clearly identified on the station maps.
That issue. Okay, Barbara.
Yep. That's it. Should I go?
You have
commercial naming rights. Commercial names?
Yep.
Okay. So currently, and I know we've spent a lot, or you spent a lot of time on this issue before, the policy is silent. And really, the whole issue of commercial naming rights is really from what we have treated as more of advertising, kind of taken an advertising approach. Some allow it, some don't. You heard me talk about how a couple of agencies are getting much more aggressive about it. The customers continue to say, or the ones that participate in focus groups, we heard some of this also in the budget feedback, that they're not in favor of it unless there is some huge or a great significant amount of money that comes with it. But
mostly they would not, don't they favor it because of the changeability of it, the selling of the name is just not, it hasn't, isn't well received. In our recent round of focus group work, we talked about what it is that we do here, which is, it's called station domination. So we have been trying to be a little bit more aggressive about allowing, for instance, there's a recent orange juice brand, Tropicana, that took over Gallery Place. So they did floor graphics, they did wall graphics, they had the station signs. And we've been very successful at that, and they were, when we explained all of that in the research, they were really receptive to that. What it does allow us to do, I think, is take advantage of getting the revenue without changing the name. And we've also been, with the help of Dave and Jack's teams, we have opened up a little bit on the exterior of vehicles. I just saw some on the 1000 series. So we're also being more aggressive about selling the sides or three quarters of the sides of a bus, or looking at putting more advertising on the side of some of our older vehicle or rail cars. And in this last year, I'll tell you that our advertising budget, we were budgeted for $15 million, and we came in at a little over $18 million. So even though we have some challenges around when we're preparing the system, we have to take some of our signage down, we're still achieving what we were because we're trying to be mindful of trying to make more and more revenue versus so where we could go with this is to continue that, is to continue the practice where we are, to continue to be aggressive about advertising opportunities separate and apart from literally changing the name. But another option is to, if we did go down that route, that we should come up with guidelines that if we were going to do commercial naming rights, for instance, that it should be something that, you know, associated with that station or in close proximity, that it not be controversial because it's a reflection on us, and that we have commercial use regulations, which you've heard Carol O'Keefe opine on, that we need to be consistent and true to. My recommendation is that we stay with where we are, that we continue to be aggressive with our advertising program as much as we can, and that we not change the station names themselves.
I agree with your recommendation, but I would like to see Jim's suggestion. Perhaps we can do something that's a cross between wayfinding and advertising, but might still bring us some revenue.
If there's no other comment on Barbara's presentation, I would recognize Eliza Voigt, who is speaking for Bob Vogel from the National Park Service. Bob Vogel is here. Sorry, it didn't show up on the sheet. Bob Vogel for the National Park Service.
All right. Thank you very much. As you know, the National Park Service has been working closely with DDOT to change the Metro Rail Station name and Smithsonian Metro Station to include National Mall. In fact, the station name was recommended by DDOT. However, the WMATA board at its November 3rd, 2011 meeting deferred the decision, as a concern was raised that the name change may result in overcrowding and sea issues, and subsequently we have met with WMATA. We believe that adding the name National Mall to the Smithsonian Station meets the criterion stated in the station naming policy you are discussing today. The National Mall identifies the station location by geographic feature and by the center of activity. The Smithsonian is actually an institution within the National Mall. The criterion also states that the landmark should be within half a mile, and the station is actually located on the National Mall. And Reiters stated that an institution should be added to a station name if it is the major reason Reiters are using the station, And we believe that the Smithsonian is just one of the many reasons that the 25 million residents and visitors come to the National Mall. The name change also supplements the new National Park Service pedestrian wayfinding system for the National Mall that we've done in partnership with the Trust for the National Mall, which highlights access to multiple metro stations. So we are working hard to make sure people know there are multiple ways to it. And we also believe that we understand name length, and we are willing to work with you, continuing to do that, looking at options such as National being abbreviated, such as it is on 395 highway signs, and working with you on that. We think that we have local jurisdiction support. We find that there's fund commitment from the National Trust and the National Park Service. We look forward to continuing to work with DDOT and WMATA in the next phase of station name changes, and appreciate the time today.
Thank you. Next, we have Caroline Cunningham for the Trust for the National Mall.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. My name is Caroline Cunningham, and I'm the president of the Trust for the National Mall. And I don't want to go over much of what Bob said, but I do want to reiterate one point that I think this is very much in keeping in the policy recommendations that WMATA is receiving. I do want to address one issue and one concern about the neighborhood maps, and I think this is one solution to include the National Mall in neighborhood maps. However, with 25 million people coming to the National Mall each year and making plans for their trip, I think it's very important that they get that information as a station name change rather than a local map, which will not address their particular concerns when they are located throughout the greater Washington region for their visitation. I am excited about the name change, having been a Washingtonian for 25 years and come to the National Mall since I was four. But I do think that this policy that you are articulating is spot on, and it also fits very well with the institutionalizing of National Mall Smithsonian as the station. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, I might add that in the letter to the chair of WMATA, they both organizations indicate funding support for this effort. So I wanted to add that.
We have a series of staff recommendations that the committee needs to consider as a recommendation to the full board. Among those is the issue of the handling of the naming of the National Mall. I would suggest that you take a look at the recommendations, two pages from the staff, and if you have a suggestion, concern, modification about these specific modifications, now would be the time to raise them as a specific concern. Mr. Giancola.
So it's the time, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, clearly, I support the adding National Mall and the station itself and the maps associated with the station, and I suppose I will recommend that. Now, at this point, my personal feeling is that I think the National Mall is itself the destination. Smithsonian is one of the activities on the mall, so I would recommend and move that we change that station to National Mall, primary letters, Smithsonian, secondary letters.
Remind me of the time frame going forward for the next map.
If you go a couple slides, next, go next, please.
Agree.
We need to finalize the next map July.
By July of next year. Mr. Tanner.
Following school on that. The presentation from the suggests that the current policy would permit this change. So it's not an issue of how we would amend the policy, it's an issue of how we address the request, if and when the request comes to us. So if I could comfortably vote for the policy, I'd still say we'd be out there to make the change when we're making the change.
I think you're getting at what I was going to raise. If we vote for this policy, then that still allows us to change it. And would that be your preferred approach, General Manager?
Yes, we prefer we address the policy today, and then when we get to the next stage, there'll be other requests for station name changes, probably, and this could be one considered at that time.
And wouldn't be precluded?
Not precluded at all.
Okay. Would you be okay with that, Tony?
I would be okay with that, but, you know, I'd be interested to know what kind of support we have for certainly including the national mall in there. So I would withdraw my motion, but I would like to hear some thoughts on support for the fact that we probably do need to have national mall entitled somewhere.
So with Mr. Giancola's statement, then I guess you want a motion, and someone who's on the committee needs to do that, on the policy statement first. So that
policy
we
statement
can,
is the primary
right, the
business
yeah,
today.
And then come back and talk about timing
yes.
and what that means with this particular recommendation.
Mr. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the commercial issue, I support the idea that we should not be commercializing, auctioning off stations and the like. I would reserve the thought that if some commercial entity wanted to build us a new station, that in fact would be associated with that particular neighborhood.
We'll buy some rail cars.
Put the name on the rail car.
No question.
And I would remind us all how the staff had to come to this set of recommendations we asked. At the last board meeting when we did the final round of station naming decisions, just to come back and clarify policy and position on several issues, they have done that in this set of recommendations, and so that this is actually in response to board direction. Ms. Porter?
Can I make a couple of suggestions for specific changes on the station name changes policy resolution? One is under education universities, the second bullet, revised policy to limit future names to main campuses within 1/2 mile. To put language in there, there says something in additional with limits or kind of limits on enrollments in order to be eligible or something like that. And the second thing is under hospitals to have language that parallels the landmarks that says something, and I wouldn't say encourage, I would say require hospitals be included by name on neighborhood and interactive maps. I would add that to retain current practice or whatever.
Is a motion?
Yes, I'll make it a motion.
I just want to clarify timing on that. It could be required in retain the maps now or as we change maps.
I would be okay with that as we change maps.
Motion has been made. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Motion made and seconded. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? And with that, a motion to approve the staff recommendation as amended.
So moved.
Second.
Motion made and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Part two. Rail service criteria.
So I have to stay for the whole thing. was, no question.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon again. The purpose slide. Andrea Burnside, Chief Performance Officer, here to talk about an action item on rail criteria. And before we get into the presentation, I kind of just like to say a few remarks to sort of set the stage for this discussion and action today. Service criteria have a very long history of being used at Metro. The issue is that they're not formal criteria. In other words, they're not board-adopted criteria. So essentially what we're proposing for the board's action today is to make the criteria that we've been using for many, many years official. Board members are aware of the processes that we have in place that are endorsed by you, being robust decisions, but we need to have the same thing on the rail side of the house. What we're not proposing today is a set of criteria designed to reduce rail service. I think there's some talk out there about the purpose of this, and that's not the intention at all. In fact, for customer criteria is intended to protect them. Today, there's no limit set by the board on how wide headways can be, and as you know, the wider the headways, the more services. Instead, it's kind of up to staff to choose what how to schedule train departures from terminal stations. The board action will set limits, outside limits, on the widest headways, the type of service we can schedule even during track work is kind of an example. We also like to revisit something I think some of you have seen before, which is looking at our peer agencies and how they use rail service criteria. We share the results of 9 transit agencies, and we'll kind of recap that today. Tom Harrington is here today, and he's going to go through kind of the detail on the service criteria, how we use the criteria today for long-range planning, capital improvement planning, annual operating budget development, and short service adjustments. So he'll go into a little more detail on that. And then finally, we'll recommend board action. And kind of jumping ahead to the very last slide, I'd also like to say kind of as a stage setter that it's a pretty complex subject. We've had a working group here of staff members talk about this for a few months now. So the action today is intended as a beginning and not the be-all that ends all. We fully expect to have additional service criteria, and kind of that's shown into the next step slide. So with that, I'd like to move into kind of why move towards board approval. I think the main point here is really the last point on the slide here, which is that the Governance Committee has adopted bylaws in July 2011, and one bylaw speaks specifically to this topic, that the board would like to work in itself as a policymaking body, and the recommended action today moves you in that direction. Other points here, this topic has been discussed by the board a number of times in the past, but really no criteria have resulted. With regard to Metro Rail being a regional system needing regional standards, we have a complex system. It's designed to be very convenient to customers, but it is regional. So 71% of Vienna customers, for example, that enter the station there, Fairfax County residents, nearly all of them make trips to destinations outside of Fairfax County. So people are moving all throughout the region, all throughout different jurisdictions. If you looked at our bus system, we evaluate that at a line level. But on the rail system, with the hub and spoke network, interline rails, which are good at increasing the options for travelers moving through the system, it provides maximum capacity, but it does mean that a delay on a single line can generate ripple effects throughout the system. Again, just trying to reiterate that this is a regional system in regional standards. Having an adopted policy has the benefit of keeping decisions objective rather than subjective, and I think Dave Kubicek might have an example of decisions made about 4 car trains in the past.
Yeah. We've talked about this beforehand where we were budgeted for 4 car trains. Actuality of it, we really needed, 6 and 8 car trains. Whenever the decision was made to follow the budget, it was just an unrealistic expectation due to our crowding and everything else that was taking place. And it lasted probably for about 2 or 3 weeks, and there was a huge upcrowd on that. I think the other criteria as we look at this is it's the service level inside the core versus the outlying areas, of the railroad. And I'll let them get back to their presentation.
With regard to Title VI requirements, the Federal Transit Administration has guidance for compliance with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, namely that grant recipients should have quantitative system-wide service standards to guard against discriminatory service design practices and decisions. Our civil rights group here at Metro, working with my office, has in the past submitted our vital signs, key performance indicator, rail on time performance, which is based on headways, combined with census information and survey data to illustrate to FTA how we're in compliance. So I already noted the last bullet here about why it's important to move towards approval. We can move now to the next slide, which is the benchmarking slide that some of you have seen before. And just to kind of orient you to the slide on the left side, we have the agencies that we benchmark ourselves against. And when we do benchmarking, as I've said in the past, we try to select agencies most like us, not just everybody who's out there, but there's actually a tool called the Integrated National Transit Database Analysis System, long word there. But it helps us find systems that are similar to ours in terms of they have rail, same population, vehicle miles operated. So that reflects, the list here reflects the systems most like us. The criteria across the top, as you can see, headway frequency means time between trains. Span of service is safely what hours do you operate. Passengers per car, also known as loading standards, is an indicator of how crowded cars are at peak stations. Service delivery is basically how we adhere to our headways, so that's our rail on-time performance measure. And then fare recovery is operating costs covered by passenger fares. The legend basically shows that there's a checkbox that that agency has a formally adopted standard. No check means that they use it in plan, similar to what we do, but it's not formal. We have a checked box, as you notice up there, for span of service, and it's really should be like a half check. Because we do have some existing board policy that defines what to do when we open early or run late for special events, so it's sort of a half check. But we do not have a policy, which we're here to talk to today about defining what our normal service hours of operation are. And then R means reported but not used. So we report the, as you know, on-time performance headway adherence measure. So what are the takeaways from this fairly complicated chart for you? One commonality is that headways and passengers per car or the loading are the two most common criteria used by agencies in service planning. But otherwise, there's kind of a lot of different variation. Service delivery is commonly monitored and reported. As I said, we do through vital signs, looking at how well we adhere to the headways or the time between trains. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Tom Harrington.
Okay, while we not have board-adopted service criteria, we certainly have used service criteria, in order to make important planning, operations, and budgetary decisions. For planning, there have been a variety of corridor and system-level studies, particularly looking at capacity analysis, where we've used passenger load as a criteria. And certainly for all service planning, both short and long-term, we look at headway and frequency of service. Typically, those don't come to the board until we get closer to implementation. For important capital decisions, such as fleet procurement, we've used passengers per car, just PPC, to basically look at the amount of capacity needed and to determine the peak vehicle requirement. These are documented in our fleet plans. Those are typically brought to the board approval. For the annual operating budget, there is a service plan which specifies the service levels of all the criteria we're talking about today, and that's in the published adopted budget book. We also bring major service changes to board typically, and the most recent example being Rush Plus, which was approved by the board in October. Today's focus, though, is on the lower box, which are really short-term decisions made about regular non-emergency service. And so while past decisions have been made about how we schedule track work, how we reallocate eight-car trains, how we allocate tripper trains, which are specific peak trains in the direction that we use to manage loads, those have all been done by management. But what we're doing really today is to formalize and to make it more clear when the general manager and staff can make changes and when we really need to seek board approval. So now look at the criteria in more detail. The first one being span of service. This criteria basically determines when customers can expect us to be open for business. The thresholds are, in effect, our operating hours. So we open at 5 a.m. on weekdays, 7 a.m. on weekends. We close at midnight on Sunday through Thursday, and then we have late night hours Friday and Saturday nights. We do, as Andrea said, have a separate policy on special event openings and closings, which are typically reimbursed. But otherwise, changes to the operating hours would require board approval, and that's what the policy is saying. So next, headway, which is the time between trains. And here, the policy that we're talking about today has a threshold defined in this way. Trains on all lines will be scheduled to depart from the terminal stations no more than 15 minutes apart during the peak times and 30 minutes apart during non-peak times. Andrea already mentioned we're not proposing any service level reductions with these criteria. Today's service plan, as documented in the budget books, again, I think we reiterated with the Rush Plus plan, typically has 6-minute headways on all lines at the terminal stations and 12 minutes on midday and Saturday, 15 minutes on Sunday. Because of the design of our system where we have interlining in the core, we typically find headways of 3 minutes on those sections where we have more than two lines. So our actual headways are much lower than these upper limits, and they are relatively high. But what we're, as I think Andrea also referred to, we're not just about a regular service, we also are talking about track work. And so there are times where we do need to raise headways because of fork and other special operating scenarios, and that's one reason for the upper limit. But the implication, we have a terminal, the implication is also that we would not want any segment to be scheduled with headways above 15 minutes in the peak. And where I think that's important is with our current operating plan on the Rush Plus, we do have service between Pentagon and Roslyn with up to 12 minute headway right now. And so again, I think we're trying to keep that in mind as we look at upper limits on headway.
Mr. Chairman. I need to note for the record, my colleague Mary Hines couldn't be here today, but she specifically asked me to say that she feels that the 30 minutes is way too long, and especially given the fact that we booked the budget, I think, the 15 minutes. And I think she sees this as, in fact, a service reduction. And I'm not sure I get that on the record here, because I know when it comes before the board, I guess we have to vote on it at on the 26th. But I wanted to reserve the opportunity for Mary to speak to that and give you some more reasons why. But I don't know if she has raised that with you in the past, or if you guys have any reaction at all to the difference, and do you, because her concern was if, in fact, you are going to do that, that is a reduction, and that the board needs to basically, I guess, in the budget or when we vote to recognize that.
The Tom can add to this, but 30 minutes is, I think, driven by our track work when we have the single track. Because of sometimes the location of the track work and the distance between interlockings where you can cross trains over, we actually, and this has been the practice to date, it's not something for, you know, new for the future, is there are times where we cannot manage that within 20 minutes. It gets up to 23, 25 minutes, as I recall. And that's why we're just using it as a policy thing to allow for that kind of single tracking as part of our state of the repair that go up to a half hour on off-peak periods.
I thank you. I think Mr. Dyke is reflecting Ms. Hines' concern, but I think I wanted to just share the discussion we had yesterday in doing that, in that it, I think, as the general manager stated, this speaks to a different piece versus what, as Andrea explained before, that dispel the fact that this is really a service reduction, that this is the max out, and that our focus is to keep within the guidelines we have now so that we make sure that we are getting the same service delivery, but it gives a policy guideline as to what the max of the normal service is. Now, if her concern is about the larger piece, I agree, but I just want to say we did discuss that as an understanding of where this policy is with us.
Mr. Downey.
I think it's important to distinguish between standard that would be applied in creating the schedules versus a standard that would be permitted when we're varying the schedule. I can understand the thought that if we're doing track work or the like, we still strive to be no worse than 30 minutes with proper notice. But I think we should also have a standard that addresses what is normal policy scheduling. And you know, I'd be more comfortable with something that 15 minutes asterisk could be stretched to 30 under unusual circumstances, but shouldn't be identified as 30 open to what be used at any time and scheduled at any time. And I didn't really understand this until we've been talking about it, whether it was the schedule or the construction operations.
Mr. Porter?
I have some of the same concerns, and I guess I have a question. In terms of the criteria, why are you using maximum rather than average headways?
Again, I think it was the upper limit trying to be defined with the maximum. And as I said, right now it's pretty standard across most lines, being 6 minute being our 12 being midday. The blue having the pattern now of alternating between a 6 and a 12 minute headway in the peak being extended. And that's again just for one line, but if you want to dig down a little deeper, we have patterns in terms of origin to destinations that are different. Because of Rush Plus, we have some trips from Franklin to Greenbelt that are on 18 minute headways. But I think what we're really trying to get at when we terminal is the frequency of trains leaving that endpoint. And on that, it's typically 6 minutes.
And it's common at all services at least at endpoint.
I share some of the concerns that people have, and I understand what you're trying to do, but I'm also worried about the phenomenon of you get what you measure. And I'm afraid if we start measuring sort of the criteria and nothing goes beyond, say, 30 minutes non-peak, then it doesn't really control what the customer or the actual customer sees on a daily basis, which is, I mean, I can understand we don't want to go beyond 30 minutes under any circumstances. My guess would be most of our riders are more concerned about what they see on a daily basis. And so if we're going to set criteria, and again, this discussion has been helpful, if we're going to set criteria, we ought not to just go to the maximum, but we ought to set some kind of criteria, maybe by line or by time of day for average headways too, because that's going to be more what most people are going to see.
One point I'm going to touch on in a minute about how we would apply this. I think the annual service plan is a very important tool that will get, I think, at what you're talking about, because really picking one number for the system-wide doesn't help that much. You really need to look at it on a line-by-line basis and understand the headways. That's always been in the budget book. It underlies the budget numbers, and I think we could try to be more transparent about getting that out with the proposed budget, so that you see the headways that are proposed the upcoming year. And again, this is really, in some ways, dealing with those variances that are more the special exception that we were just talking about.
So let me follow up. So what does this do, this maximum headways? I understand what you've just said, but I'm not, if we are operating most of these things on average anyway, then why do we need this at all?
The intent here was to set the outside limits, as I said initially, and this is a first step towards establishing a robust set of rail service criteria. I think some of the comments you're making today about standards for average and so on, we can move in that direction going forward. This is, again, kind of step one of the process, not the end point.
What happens if we violate this criteria? I mean, supposing we're doing track work and stuff gets hung up and this train is 30 minutes behind the one in front of it.
From my perspective, as we start looking at this 30 minutes, it's really better for us. We started taking the approach that in the shutdown, because the residual effect of being able to evaluate in the rest of the alignments and the back it has potentially in loading and crowding and everything else, this is the direction that we're trying to, you know, to move towards.
Yeah, just that, again, as Andre said, these are the outside parameters. For instance, when we start scheduling the Silver Line, you know, there'll be an outside parameter. To answer your particular point, if we're running single tracking, it's going to show up as degraded on-time performance, and that shows up in a report to the board. That's how it shows up.
So that if it goes beyond this, it becomes a reportable problem.
Well, really not even getting to this, just the schedules that were mentioned in the annual budget, and that says we're going to run every 6 minutes during peak, you know, whatever, in the off-peak. And during the weekdays, if we're not adhering within a certain tolerance to those schedules, it shows degraded performance rather than being, you know, 93% on time. If we run a lot of single tracking at night, that shows up, it could be, say, you're 70% on time. But it then rolls up into our overall percentage. And frankly, the way we run the operation is we're watching that. I told you that this year we're going to try to, in manual operation, try to be greater than 90% on performance. He and I are watching it very closely, and if it's impacting us, we make adjustments so that we get into that territory.
I was going to add that we already report on headways through the rail on time performance, as General Minister did, and with regard to span of service, and which Tom hasn't even gotten to, the passengers per car, those be added into the vital signs as an information in the detail pages for tracking purposes?
The question, going back to more, would it be appropriate then to go with what you said, which was it would be 15 minutes, but then asterisk it that on the extraordinary circumstances, it could go up to 30?
And that's fine. I mean, we can operate that way.
All right. Well, and then, and that also, I think, would allow Mary the opportunity, if she wants to address that at the 26th, to do so at that point.
Well, I think it's important that if we have a board member who has a concern about this service criteria, it's fair to say that this is not going to be understood by our writing public about what this is, what it means, and how we use it. And criteria have to have credibility with all the stakeholders. Part of building the flexibility and to recognize unique circumstances creates a potential credibility gap with our customers about understanding what it is we're saying are our acceptable criteria for rail service. I'm agreeing 100% with Mr. Downey's assumption of having the service criteria be what we've already said our performance criteria is, which is
6, 12, 15,
and we have a specific set-aside that says, with exceptional requirements on the system or something to that effect about work and other events, this is our service criteria. It makes clear what our expectations are going forward about our service to our riders. I've gotten a lot of email back from folks saying, what are you doing? And I have tried to explain a bit about service criteria, and it's a harder sell. I find I have a hard time packaging the message back to riders. I want us to be very sensitive to message to customers in this.
I guess I'm unclear myself now, and I thought it was clear. We're saying that these are the outside limits of what we would deliver. But we also are saying we have in the service plan the clear targets within the service plan of what the delivery would be. And if I heard you right, Downey, it was 6, 12, and 15. Is that correct?
That's what we heard.
Okay, so I'm confused as to what is down now. Is that because other, and we will see the on-time performance measured against the 6, 12, and 15, because it will all aggregate into what generates it. Are we not conveying clearly to the public that in order to reach that, we will never exceed the 15? Okay. Okay.
Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, I was going to say earlier I support the approach Mr. Downey is suggesting. From what I heard earlier, you're basing service criteria on the worst possible situation. I have trouble with that. I just doesn't make much sense to do it that way. My own personal experience after riding the rail metro for 31 years is that, and maybe I've been lucky, I've never really, I can say the longest I've ever had to wait is about 22 minutes, ever. Now, that doesn't include when we actually close the system. You know, clearly that's a whole different situation. So I'm just having a little trouble with the 30 minutes, and I think Mr. Desimanoch may be a way of getting around that.
Kind of consensus about.
Yeah. I
get to the
And we do have another slide on how we're going to apply the criteria. Maybe we'll come back to that once we've touched on passenger car, which hopefully is a little more straightforward as a criteria. The criteria of passengers per car is how we measure crowding. It's how crowded the customer should expect the trains to be. We've had a well-established upper limit criteria, and that is the crowding on board trains shall not exceed 120 persons per car. It's measured on weekday in peak hour in the peak direction at the maximum load points in the system, which are for each line where we have the highest load. We also have in here for the first time a lower limit of 80 passengers per car. So for reference, a Metrorail car typically can handle up to around 180, 185 passengers, you know, fully crush load. The seated load per car, but on most of our newer cars, it's about 66 seats per car. So at 120, we're talking about standees, you know, approaching 60 standees per car. After we've defined headways, really the passenger per car measure is the next key factor in determining our service levels in terms of how much service and really how many rail cars will be out there. The bus headways have precedent. So if we say we're going to run a train every 6 minutes on a line, that's how many trains will be. We have a little more flexibility in train length and in tripper trains, in particular the use of 8-car trains to handle crowding. Our goal is really balance loads across all lines. And while our upper limit's been 120, in practice, 100 persons per car has been kind of a target for a number of years. So when we look at allocation of rail cars, we really want to make sure that we're aiming for that. In our most rail fleet plan, 100 per car is what we've used to determine how many new rail cars we need to purchase. The purpose of upper and lower limit is really, obviously, we want to make sure that if we have one or two lines that are well below 80 and we're putting extra 8-car trains on those or tripper trains, and we have another line that's above 100, we want to reallocate cars, basically, to try and balance loads across all lines, recognizing it's a regional system and we want to do this objectively across the system. So that's really how this will be used. Whereas the measure really for headway was on-time performance, which we already report, would be something that, while it has been measured and reported, it maybe is not as widely seen as on-time performance, and we're going to talk about maybe how we can improve our reporting of crowding going forward. Okay, so and we touched on this already, but in terms of how criteria would be applied by management, first is an annual service plan, and that, as part of the budget book, is documented. But that should specify and does specify on an annual basis what the span, the frequency of the headway, and then the crowding is determined in terms of what the mix of 6- and 8-car trains, the use of tripper cars. All those basically should be spelled out in the service plan, and should be part of the budget approval process. Decisions about reallocating 8-car trains, tripper trains to manage loads, are something where we would be using that crowding measure to look at. And similarly, decisions about turnbacks, which is if we had the ability, in a lot of cases we don't, but if we had the ability to end train service, not at the end of the line, but at a midpoint where we potentially had a pocket track, we'd be looking both at frequency provided to make sure we're maintaining the right frequency, but then also looking at crowding to determine those decisions. And we already talked about monitoring and using on-time performance as a current key KPI with headway. We could look at PPC as a potential new KPI that we report. And then, obviously, the span of service would come into play when a request for early openings or late closings.
Okay, so this slide here just kind of summarizes what we've already shown you in the more detail in the previous slides, recommending board approval of these rail service criteria and the thresholds we discussed, really referring to normal service and not emergency type service. I wanted to highlight that as well. And the board would delegate responsibility to the general manager to make service changes based on these criteria and report back to the board when such action is taken. I say that these service changes cannot go above jurisdictional funding requirements or beyond amounts provided for in the current budget. And the final slide is, as I alluded in the beginning, We don't see this as the final step in developing rail service criteria. It's really the first step in that direction. So we would establish guidelines for application of the criteria, more specific guidelines, develop data monitoring and reporting procedures. Tom mentioned how we manually collect passenger counts today. We also have technology that we use, models that we kind of look at the manual counts next to the model and look at accuracy. So develop some procedures on that. Review future rail service criteria. We heard from the jurisdictional coordinating committee and other folks about, you know, concern about vehicle crowding for off peaks on weekends and locations outside max load points. Platform crowding has been an issue that's come up many times. I know as a board talk with stakeholders about the strategic plan, that's a concern that stakeholders have. And then passenger comfort, you know, are the stations clean and air conditioned and the vehicles as well. So those are the proposed next steps that staff would continue to work on and developing the criteria. And that concludes our presentation.
Any comments, Ms. Porter?
I'm still not understanding how the headway criteria gives us any additional any information that we would use in a different way than we would average headways.
The purpose of the headways that are being talked about here are the outer limits. In other words, if we had light passenger on cars, which another circumstance we could say you should be doing every 20 minutes headway. We can't go beyond 15 because a policy set by the board is 15 minutes, even though you have light loadings on the car, because you want to provide that kind of transit service as opposed to a commuter service. Where you could go up to an hour, say. And that's getting a little ridiculous for, you know, LaMonta. But that's the purpose, is setting outer limits that we can't go beyond that. As was referred to before, on the yellow line, blue line, Rush Plus, we're now, at certain points, we are up to 4 minutes, 9 or 12 minute headway for certain trains coming out of terminal. We cannot go beyond that when we do the planning. When you're talking about the, when you're talking about schedule adherence, that's when we actually set up the headways, or front street, if you will, of the trains to meet the requirements with regard to the passenger loadings on the car. We want to keep it below 100, 120, and possibly, and also keep it above 80. That's the envelope we're operating in. So we're putting in headways, establishing the schedules for the trains based on trying to attain those loadings, and there's a balancing back and forth. We end up coming up with a schedule, that allows us to live within those parameters. When we do that, that shows up in the budget book, and then we operate against that for the coming year, and that's where we measure on-time performance again. So I think we have maybe an issue is the outside parameter is not something we measure against. That sets the outer limit. I have to come back and tell you if we're violating that limit, but it's an outer limit. What we're really measuring in terms of service on a day-to-day basis is how we adhere to the schedule we set up at the beginning of each year based on the other criteria that I just mentioned. Passenger loading is one good example of it.
Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, if we're going to make an adjustment to the non-peak times, according to the Downey formula, do we want to consider it also for the peak times? And then that's one question. And then secondly, do we have similar criteria, or have we developed criteria on the bus side like this?
For another day.
Mr. Downey?
Looking at the solution itself, the description is proves headway, trains on all lines shall be scheduled to depart, which I think is different from what we've been talking about. Schedule to me means what we set up and expect to offer, as opposed to having to be. I don't think a transit system can offer a 30-minute headway. You know, that's well beyond the, that means it's commuter rail. You have to know what time the train is going. 30 minutes really is not a purpose. And in the off-peak, it's not going to be an issue of balancing the number of people on the train. So,
you know, I would agree. Yeah. And if we take into account the Downey exception, 20 minutes is probably the appropriate. I'd double-check that.
20 is right at the limit of people's willingness to walk up. And exactly. 10 is better, but 20 is kind of possible.
So we're amending the resolution to reflect the Downey.
The Downey amendment.
Okay. I like to think of it as a Downey.
Why don't we suggest to come back to the board with appropriate amended language.
Could I also suggest that there are limits to measuring crowding as on average weekdays in the peak hour, peak direction at the maximum load point as a single criteria about how a line is performing. It measures one critical problem that we have about, for instance, station capacity, but it's not necessarily a good indicator of crowding on segments, for instance, of lines and how you might manage that. One of the things that strikes me when Dave was mentioning the furtive decision to eliminate the Glen cut or turnback, that if memory serves me right, that was based on nothing other than a guess about cost, frequency, passenger loadings, et cetera. There were no criteria that the board had for making a decision about eliminating one of the turnbacks on the red line. If ultimately this is a tool that is useful, it allows the active management of segment, not just of lines at a critical point, but it allows the management of an entire line by segment. This should be an active management tool. I think it has the same kind of policy guidance potential that bus service criteria does about making recommendations to the board about route elimination, modifications, frequency, all of that that goes into the recommendations we get from bus about bus service, including bus on-time performance, which is no more than 2 minutes early or 4 minutes late, and that becomes a criteria of accountability through the performance criteria, through the key performance indicator. And my hope is that when we get through this process, this becomes a part, an understandable component of the KPIs around rail, and that it allows us as a board to hold the general manager accountable for the allocation of scarce resources within the system to meet these kinds of issues, including lack of use or too much use by line, by station, et cetera, and becomes a an active rather than internally passive kind of management of the rail system. Having said that, this is just the very beginning of a process, and it needs a lot more refinement, and you know, I think this is okay as phase one, but we ought to get through the board's decision, the final decision on this initial proposal. We ought to start round two right away, which would include a presentation back about where these fit in the KPIs, how you use them, what kind of accountability there is, and what kind of reporting back to the board there is about modifications based on these criteria.
As well as we get into the resource decisions in the budget and capital plan, what resources will we have to provide to meet the criteria that we've set? We know that.
This becomes a capital allocation tool if it's done, if it's used right. The same way bus standards are. for the allocation of the rolling fleet. Any other comment? A motion to recommend to the board the resolution amended by the Downey Amendment. Yeah. Would you restate your amendment?
I will restate the principle behind it and hope you will properly reflect it once it's back to the board, that the principle established ranges of headway criteria, normal operation, and variance because of other conditions in the management schedules relating to the first, but if necessary, operate relating to the second.
6-9-12.
Can I just, so that means that you really are setting a criteria for normal operations and not what's in
right.
here.
Right, yeah. Yes. And hold ourselves accountable for that.
Yes. That, is that adequate for the resolution drafting process? Okay.
And that's going to be for both the non-peak and peak?
Yes.
Okay.
Motion made and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Thank you. That concludes this day. Thank you. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I'm just anxious.
We've exceeded the criteria. We can't take any more.
Mr. Downs, I'll make it very quick. One of the things that I'd also like to announce is with inauguration, we're going to be using this as an evaluation time frame to really see with some of the equipment and stuff that we've got coming on board, what are we actually able to produce whenever we're having all of these shutdowns and these single tracking events. I think so what we're trying to establish here is AM peak, off-peak day, and PM peak to keep that as undisturbed as possible. If we were to do any work during the daytime in the core, it would only be referenced around some type of an emergency type, you know, track work that we had to respond. The other component is in the outlying areas of the railroad where I have ballasted area, railroad ties, the wider headways where it goes into the 12 and 15 minutes. If I can service that within that exact schedule, we'll consider it. But right now I'm really looking to pull back. The work naturally at off-peak night from 10 o'clock until close naturally will continue to go forward, as well as what we're looking at on our weekend shutdowns. But now since we're able to kind of reestablish, we're going to need the next 6 months to really let this staff shift its direction from this guarded number 8 direct fixation and work along these bigger chunks. And I think it'll also be very positive for the customers. The other component that we had wanted to talk about, just looking ahead, is that Thanksgiving, we've already made plans where we're not conducting any work. Christmas, and as well, it also be noted as well as Thanksgiving. I'm sorry, as New Year's Eve, we'll be, you know, shutting down that type of work or activity that's taking place. And we're already starting to consider and discuss about the presidential inauguration as well as looking forward. In that down, reference in the appendix, page 65, for example, even there was some discussions about doing some around Labor Day, and with the baseball games taking place, the type of work that was there, you know, we eliminated that and we moved that off to the side. So the reference of the material that we provided is similar in format and fashion to what we've given y'all before. It's definitely, you know, a look ahead. One of the things that I will be looking at as we've done beforehand is that this is a posted environment around the single tracks, but our intention is we'll probably be able to cut some of those out as we get more proficient over the next couple of months or so with what we're doing with the shutdowns and everything else. And then this is also going to be very important for us as we start our planning for calendar year 2013 and the increase getting ready for the summer months as well as activity for Dulles. So I just wanted to kind of notify that, and I'm open for questions.
Question.
Mr. Black.
Just as a precaution, are you going to plan ahead for any possible shutdown during the time of the playoffs if the Nationals are involved in that?
In the World Series.
We will see you in New York.
That would be a good
point. We will be, naturally, just like as we do with the Capitals, you know, with the Caps and everything else, we definitely would be sensitive, you know, to the events that would be happening, you know, into the region. But just, like I said, yes, sir, it's on the radar. It's on the radar. We've been reminded by a few other folks as well.
Mr. Giancola.
Well, Mr. Dyke stole my thunder. I was going to bring up the series, but are you a Mets or a Yankees fan, Rich?
You may not want to answer that.
Yankees.
Take the fifth.
All right. That's okay.
I also wanted to reaffirm the commitment that you have made. If you've got a line that has a shutdown, you're also not going to at the same time single track?
Yes, that's correct. We've got some areas where it gets very complicated on the orange and blue, yellow, where you have certain outages. And so what we're being very sensitive is to make sure that it's not in a hard area, and we want to kind of leave the rest of the line on the other end, you know, open. And I think there was a few areas that we noted in there that we're working on. And that's also part of the reason why stepping away from the daytime work, because that was kind of a substitute for us to try to keep the pace on some of the other repair efforts, since all of our focus was on the NTS, you know, yard number eights. And we're approaching this the same thing, just like what Mr. Troopage showed us as well. It's about getting and attaining that state of good repair. So just the same planning that we did, and what we were able to hold to on the guarded number eights with the NTSB starting back in 2009. This next 6 months is very critical for us to really to be able to establish and ratchet up what we're going to be able to push here in the next couple of years.
Our customers will thank you.
You bet.
If I haven't forgotten anything else, I'll call the committee adjourned. Thank you.